This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. When it comes to keeping up with the news from the Middle East, it can be overwhelming. The information you get, you may feel just distorted. You don't know who to believe, and you wonder if it'll ever make any sense. But it is arguably the most important region in the world, certainly from a religious point of view, and also in regards to energy production and our military. So we simply can't just afford to give up and bury our heads in the sand. And you can't accuse Professor Juan Cole of doing that. He's recognized as a leading expert in the world on the region, the history and the people. His newest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, and he also wrote Engaging the Muslim World, and he has the respected blog Informed Comment. It's at juancole.com. And Professor Juan Cole, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to talk about the book, but we got you for the full hour, so I want to start off talking more broadly. And I want to bring up this old saw, this myth, this fable that comes up all the time when people talk about the Middle East, the fable of the scorpion and the frog and trying to get across the river. And then the scorpion stings the frog and says, why did you do that? Because it's the Middle East. You've probably heard this a million times, but I just want to say, I mean, is this story, this myth, is this just patently offensive to bring this up as an explanation of the Middle East?
Well, I think the original story says because I'm a scorpion, so maybe it's suffered in the translation. But sure, I mean, you know, the Middle East is like Europe or East Asia or any or the United States or any other place in the world. The people are doing things because it makes sense to them to do it. They have goals they're trying to reach, and we don't throw up our hands when we study World War One and say, you know, why in the world are the French and the British and the Germans so weird? We try to figure out, well, were they fighting over control of markets? Was it a different kind of competition? But, you know, and we historians, we're about trying to get the explanation for why people behave as they do.
But frequently we hear this opinion that, or it's a, I think it's a prejudiced opinion and maybe even a race based that people feel that's where they are there. They just fight each other and there's no sense to it. But you go deeper and you bring the sense to it in your writings and your exploration of it. But I want to get to the fact that people need to wipe away that idea that people there, the Arabs in the Middle East, they can't function as in a democratic society.
Well, you know, democracy as a system of governance is extremely diverse. I mean, the Italians don't do it the way the Americans do it, and each country has its own approach. You know, you have countries like Japan where there are regular elections and there are political parties, but there's a sense in which there's kind of, you know, an establishment that's always in power no matter what. And so everybody does what we call democracy differently. And there are countries in the Arab world that have long experiences, at least with parliamentary elections. Lebanon is one, and then there are countries that have gone to a parliamentary system recently, like Tunisia. So, and then there are countries that, you know, looked like they were going in that direction, like Egypt, and then fell back into authoritarianism. So it's a mixed picture, but certainly there's no reason to say or assert that people who speak the Arabic language are somehow ipso facto, you know, immune from the charms of parliamentary rule.
So currently we look at the headlines and from the Middle East and we see a lot of bad news. We see ISIS or ISIS. What's the correct way to describe that organization? I've heard you say ISIS.
Well, it doesn't make any difference. It styles itself as the Islamic State now, or IS. They used to be the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, and before that they were Al-Qaeda in the Mesopotamia. So they've had a lot of different names. But they are characterized by extreme brutality and viciousness, and by an interpretation of Islam that is shared by virtually no one else. So they're a kind of a political cult, certainly would be viewed by most Muslims with horror and as a heresy. And they have, because of the political and social turmoil in Syria and Iraq, and the Iraqi side that was kicked off by the United States, they've managed to take some mainly desert regions, relatively poorly populated. They hold a city in Syria called Raqqa, which is, I think, 70,000 population. But in Iraq now, they've at least in coalition come to be dominant in some larger places like Mosul, which is a city the size of Houston.
And they said they've set up a caliphate. Can you describe what that is? If it means anything, does that resonate with the Arab-speaking world?
No, I mean, there had been an institution in medieval Islam of the caliphate. There was the Abbasid Caliphate that ended with the Mongol invasion in 1258. But there hasn't been a recognized a caliph in the Muslim world for a very long time. There were some Ottoman sultans in the 19th century who styled themselves that way. But this is a small cadre organization. We thought they had 5,000 to 10,000 fighters. They may be somewhat bigger now. But very extreme in their views and their actions. So, I mean, I say it's kind of as though some small white supremacist organization in the United States and announced that its leader was the Pope. I mean, it's absurd on the face of it.
But they have managed to grab territory in Iraq, and they have tried to assert themselves as the defenders of the Sunnis. And is that taking hold? Are we going to see them able to partition Iraq?
Well, I don't personally think that they are likely to be extremely long-lived. The neighbors don't want them there. Iran doesn't want them there. Syria doesn't want them there. The Syrian government seems gradually to be gaining some momentum in its fight against the rebels in Syria. The Russians don't want them there. The United States doesn't want them there. The Shiites of Iraq don't want them there. So they have a lot of very powerful enemies, and that they would be able to last in the medium to long term strikes me as a little unlikely. They have some advantages at the moment because of the collapse of security in eastern Syria and the collapse of the Iraqi military, which is their most proximate enemy in Iraq.
Professor Juan Cole, we're going to take a quick break. He's the author of the book, The New Arabs. We're talking about the situation in the Middle East. If you've got a question or a comment, we invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source. These are the sounds of the Arab Spring, January 2011, Tunisia. It's a topic that our guest, Juan Cole, writes about in his book, The New Arabs. He writes about how the new generation is changing the Middle East. Professor Cole, how are things changing? What is the new generation doing? Is this reason for optimism?
Well, certainly I think so. The Arab world is very young. The median age is 24. And so you have an enormous youth bulge of people. The generation I'm writing about were born between the late 1970s and the year 2000 or so. And they strike me as significantly different from their parents in many ways. And there's polling to support this assertion. They are much more urban. They've grown up in cities than their parents had been. Their grandparents were mostly farmers. They are much more literate than their parents had been. These post-colonial Arab states, for all of their authoritarianness, were dedicated to improving lives, and so they established wide-ranging school systems, and they're much more wired cosmopolitan. They have a wide range of television that they have access to, including satellite channels. They have the internet. The majority of them are on the internet, and the numbers are growing rapidly. So their horizons are just much wider than their parents had been. I think it's hard for Americans to understand. When I first went to Egypt in 1974, there was like one television station, and it was owned by the government, and the news consisted of showing President Anwar al-Sadat sitting on a Louis XIV chair with a visitor and playing John Philip Sousa music in the background for 10 minutes. And that was it. That's very different from the kind of information that this generation can consume.
And what are they doing with that information? Do they have any political leverage?
Well, just to give an example, these dictatorships in the Arab world were police states, and they deployed the police for control purposes, so they were always patting down young men in the streets, and they also engaged in a lot of arbitrary arrest. And they were very brutal, and there was widespread practice of police torture. So if you happened to fall into the hands of the police, they would do things to you. And so the youth, especially after the arrival of the Web 2.0 and the ability from about 2004 forward to show video online, the youth began arranging for video to be taken of these instances of police torture. So there was a bus driver in 2006 in Egypt who had a broom put up him by the police, and that was on video. And a whole raft of youth bloggers emerged who would mirror those videos on their blogs, and then they got picked up by satellite television, and so it went all around the Arab world. And they put pressure on the Egyptian government to stop the torture as a routine police practice. And, you know, people had always heard rumors that this was being done, but once you could actually just see it in these videos, it was visceral. And it helped to turn people against the government once they realized that this is how they were being ruled.
And this is also a time and a place where if a small group of people got together, then they could be picked up by the police and put in jail or tortured. But by using social media, they were able to work around that?
Absolutely. Yeah, there were all kinds of restrictions in these dictatorships on people gathering. So a gathering of more than five people for a particular purpose in a particular space was forbidden, and you could be arrested. Cafe owners doubled as informers for the police. They would let the police know if somebody was meeting big time and regularly, or they would just kick them out. And it was hard to find a place to meet. All the public spaces were in the hands of the government, and the private spaces were monitored by the government. It was very difficult to meet. There were a few foundations dedicated to freedom of speech and so forth that would provide meeting space. But a lot of it had to be done online, and online you could have very large meetings. In 2009, to protest the one-party state, virtual one-party state in Egypt, the youth staged a counter-party congress online, and the cyber police tried to disrupt it and send a lot of traffic its way with bots so as to stop it, but they didn't succeed entirely. So these kinds of things suddenly could be done in cyberspace that couldn't be accomplished in meat space.
We're speaking with the renowned blogger and Middle East expert, Juan Cole. He talks about the role of today's Arab youth, who they are and what they want and how what they are doing and how it can affect the world's politics. We invite you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. But these youth, they're not the only ones who are using videos and blogging and to get their message across. This is something that the Muslim Brotherhood has also taken up.
The Muslim Brotherhood, on the whole and by and large, was older and less savvy about the internet than these, frankly, left-of-center youth were. There was a blogging movement amongst Muslim Brotherhood youth. It was much smaller than among the nationalist and secular youth. And it ran into some problems because the Brotherhood doesn't look favorably upon free speech or idiosyncrasies. So these young people were a problem for it. It was a problem of organizational discipline. And the leadership sometimes cracked down on them. And many of the youth bloggers of the generation of, say, 2007 among the Muslim Brotherhood youth ended up being alienated from the movement and moving on to the more secular organizations because they faced this resistance from the older members of the organization.
Now, currently we have the conflict happening in Gaza with Hamas and the Palestinians and Israel, and we're seeing the use of social media come into play with that. In past experiences with U.S. coverage of Israel conflicts in the Middle East and Gaza, that it was pretty much coming from one direction. But we're seeing greater pressure coming from against Israel, coming from these new outlets that can't be controlled.
That's right. I think social media is making a huge impact in this particular conflict and giving the world more of a sense of what it's like to be a Palestinian in Gaza and to live under blockade and under this assault, which does seem to be at least somewhat indiscriminate. And that's not a story that was so easily perceived in the age of print because, you know, saying those things and seeing them are quite different in their emotional impact. And I think also that there is a certain amount of bias in favor of Israel in the U.S. Media and for various historical reasons. And so one sees, even today, I think far more spokespeople who represent the Israeli point of view than one sees representing the point of view of Palestinians in Gaza. And in fact, because the Palestinians are politically divided between the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and Hamas, and because the United States government considers Hamas to be a terrorist organization, what's easiest to bring on a PLO spokesman from the West Bank, from Ramallah, to talk about Gaza, but they're not in Gaza and they don't govern Gaza. So on the other hand, hearing from Palestinians in Gaza was up until yesterday fairly easy. Now the Israelis have destroyed the major electricity plant in Gaza, which is making it difficult for people to get online, and so the amount of social media has declined rapidly. It's also made it impossible for water purification to be carried out, so there's very little potable water in Gaza now. And, of course, many people have been displaced, a couple hundred thousand, to UN refugee sites, which are insecure, and some of them have been bombed.
So this is happening on our television screens, on our 24/7 news cycle. We're seeing the missile by missile launch in Gaza, but the level of awareness. I mean, it's really when you try to ask people, think's going on, people, they don't know. They see there's, oh, well, there's the terrorist, Hamas. They lob rockets one way, and Israel, is they lob rockets the other way. And they say, well, there's nothing that can be done about it. You know, but, you know, what level of awareness do people need to have? I mean, to make sense of this. People want to make sense of it.
Sure. Well, it's all in the history. I think most Americans probably understand that there were hardly any Jews in what is now Palestine in, say, 1800, they started coming in the late 19th century in some numbers, and in the early 20th century, a few tens of thousands, as a result of a new form of nationalism, Zionism, which built itself on the Jewish religion, and most American Jews, by the way, were offended by this idea of trying to enlist Judaism in a nationalist cause. Now, I don't think it probably would have amounted to all that much, but then you had in the 1930s the rise of European fascism, which had murderous intentions towards Europe's Jews, and ultimately, of course, conducted the Holocaust, and it killed 6 million. It killed a third of world Jewry, and those who managed to escape the clutches of the Nazis couldn't get out of Europe very easily, and there was no place that would accept them.
Right.
They weren't let into the United States.
Okay, we're going to continue. I know you got a long, that's a lot of history to try and get in like a minute. So we're going to take a break. We're going to break for NPR News. We're talking with Professor Juan Cole. His new book is The New Arabs. He's also wrote Engaging the Muslim World. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. For the last three decades, Professor Juan Cole has sought to put the relationship of the West and the Muslim world into a historical context. In his new book, The New Arabs, he outlines the history that led to dramatic changes in the region with the Arab Spring. We invite you to call in if you got questions or comments about what's happening right now in the Middle East. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can also email us your questions or comments at thesource@tpr.org. So, Professor Cole, back to what we were talking about before, but this is a dumb question. We keep talking about the Middle East, and it's not a very good way of describing that region, I don't think. I mean, why do we keep calling it the Middle East?
It's a term that came out of American and British naval strategy in the 19th century. At the time, Britain's main concern was holding India, which was a big, rich country and the jewel and the crown of the British Empire, and it was the East. So what lay between Britain athwart the Suez Canal and the Mediterranean and the East was the Middle East. And of course, for the United States as well, a lot of its trade and interests were further east. It really is a way of looking at the world that comes out of European colonialism and placing people in regard to strategic assets.
Well, we don't call Asia and Japan the Far East anymore. I mean, shouldn't we evolve? And what would be a better way to describe this?
Well, some people have proposed that what you're really talking about geographically is North Africa and West Asia, people have proposed various acronyms like NAWA that haven't caught on.
No.
You know, the Quakers never wanted to be called Quakers. They're the Society of Friends, but the General Society decided to call them that, and they haven't been able to shake it for 200 years, and the Middle East may be stuck too.
Okay, so we're talking about the United States in relations to the Middle East, and of course our two leaders with Israel and the United States, Barack Obama and Netanyahu. And we've heard descriptions of this as the worst relationship that we've had among these leaders. They just don't get along. Is that true? Has that had an impact on the circumstances?
Well, it's all about policy. The Likud government in Israel is a proponent, they won't say so openly, but it's clear from their policies, is a proponent of what is called Greater Israel. So they took the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. These were not areas that the United Nations General Assembly awarded them in 1948, nor were they places of traditionally of much Jewish settlement. There are 4.3 million Palestinians living there now. But they seized them in the course of the 1967 war. And with regard to the West Bank, they intend to colonize this land, which is illegal after World War II. Acquiring territory from your neighbors by war was made illegal. Sending your population as an occupying military force into occupied territory was made illegal. And the world's reaction against the excesses of the Axis. But Israel flouts that international consensus and those international laws, and so it intends to simply colonize the Palestinian territory in the West Bank. It's sent in hundreds of thousands of settlers and taken away, you know, Palestinian land and resources without any recompense.
So these are the settlements, the putting out of the continued
these are the settlements
that every president in the United States has opposed since the creation of Israel.
Yes, but there's always been a hope that, well, in the end of the day, maybe you could do a slight territory swap, or there'd still be a way to constitute a Palestinian state on that territory. But Mr. Netanyahu recently gave an interview in which he said, no, they're going to keep it forever. So the whole prospect of American foreign policy had been based on the idea since the Oslo Accords in the 90s that there would be a two-state solution, that Israel would give up the West Bank and Gaza. And it's clear it won't. The West Bank will be settled by Israeli squatters, essentially people who will be stealing Palestinian land and resources. And Gaza will remain under a severe blockade that is a blockade of civilians. Half of Gazans are children, and the blockade interferes with, doesn't allow export of anything the Palestinians make in Gaza very much, and it restricts what can be imported as well. The importation of things, you know, you could imagine there being a security rationale for blocking all exports is simply punishes collective punishment of the population, is a hope of by making them poor and unemployed that they will become docile. And so the reason that Barack Obama is so upset with Netanyahu is that these policies Netanyahu is following completely undo the Oslo peace process and also stick Israel with being a colonial enterprise that increasingly looks like apartheid South Africa. You know, Barack Obama got his start in politics when he was at Occidental College in California by protesting apartheid. So he's not very happy to have an ally that's going in very firmly and apparently in the long term in that direction.
Also, Israel, they do a calorie count of how much food can be imported into Gaza? Talk about that.
Well, they had done. I mean, that policy is over with. But back in, I think it was 2009, they sat down in a room and figured out how many calories each person in Gaza needed. And then they tried to restrict food shipments into Gaza because Gaza has no, the Israelis bombed their airport and don't let their port function. So they only get their food in from Israel. And so they tried to, one Israeli official said, we're going to put them on a diet, that they would, they weren't starving them, they weren't making them hungry, but they just kept them on the edge of survival. And this is, you know, this is about the creepiest thing I've heard of a supposedly Western democracy doing to people for decades. And there has been pressure on Israel to lighten up on that, and they don't restrict food coming into Gaza anymore on the whole, although I think there are still some items they don't let in. But there's not a nutritional crisis in Gaza per se. But if you don't let them export things and you throw them into 40% unemployment, then they don't have any money, and so they can't afford food. And so 56% of Palestinian families in Gaza before this recent war were food insecure. They weren't starving, they weren't hungry, but they were one or two paychecks away from being so. So it's a horrible situation, and it's illegal in international law to impose collective punishment on a civilian, non-combatant population in this way. I mean, Israel is doing this to try to unseat Hamas, which it doesn't like, and one can understand what it doesn't like it, and it's legitimate for Israel to fight Hamas. It's not legitimate to collectively punish Gaza, and as I said, half of them are children. They didn't vote for anybody. They're not old enough to vote.
Right, but so this all started off, the conflict we have now in Gaza with the kidnapping of these three Israeli youth and then the murdering of them. That's a terrible thing to happen. And then Hamas started shooting rockets into Israel. And so talk about this Iron Dome. What is this Iron Dome? How good is that?
Oh, the United States supplied Israel with an anti-missile system. Those anti-missile systems are just psychological. They're like a placebo in medicine to make people feel better. You can't really stop a rocket that's got a bomb in its nose from going off. So you could interrupt its flight and make it fall earlier, but you're just causing it to explode earlier.
We're seeing with such a disparity in the numbers of the three Israelis have been killed by these rocket attacks, and we have 1,365 of the Palestinians who have been killed through the rocket attacks, retaliatory attacks. So why did the disparity?
Oh, it's not the same thing at all. Those rockets that Gaza that the radicals in Gaza send out, and I should say that this is a war crime on their part, and I condemn it. But the rockets that they're sending out, you know, for the most part, when the Israelis say there have been thousands of them and so forth, they're little eighth grade high school experiments. They're nothing to speak of. They're flying pipe bombs.
Okay.
They can't go very far. They don't have guidance systems. They mostly just land harmlessly in the desert. So the real reason they haven't haven't killed very many people is that they can't. I mean,
okay.
They're not a kind of weapon system that's capable of that.
Right.
Whereas
we got to take a quick break.
500-pound I'm sorry, yes.
Professor Cole. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Just a minute. If you got questions or comments out there, call in 210-614-8980. This is The Source. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. His new book is called The New Arabs. He's also wrote the book Engaging the Muslim World. He has a widely celebrated and read blog at juancole.com, which is called Informed Comment. So when we went to break, you were talking about the missiles that were being sent from Gaza into Israel. You're saying, oh, they're not that bad. Pipe bombs, that don't really hurt anybody. I mean, still, that sounds like something you don't want going on in flying into your country. If they were doing that from Nuevo Laredo into Laredo, we'd be pretty upset.
Yes. Well, first of all, I should say that I do condemn this activity, and I don't mean to say it has no effect. It's a psychological effect. I mean, if you have an establishment or a home business in one of these towns near to Gaza, like Sderot, occasionally they do fall on them and cause damage, and occasionally they do kill people. All life is precious, but the numbers are very small. And certainly there's no proportionality in the Israeli response. I mean, the Israelis kill thousands of Gazans. And the thing that, you know, historically people don't understand is when you think about the Palestinians in Gaza, how did they get to be in Gaza? Well, over 70% of them are not from Gaza. They're from what is now Israel. They're from southern Israel. They're from places like Sderot. And the Israelis complained the Palestinians in Gaza are bothering Sderot. They don't mention that the Palestinians in Gaza used to be in Sderot, and they used to own Sderot. They used to own the farms and the houses in that place. And they, in 1948, they were chased off of their farms and houses and put in refugee camps in Gaza and then encircled and kept there in a kind of a large open-air prison. So, you know, until you give them some reparations for what was done to them, they're going to be angry about this. Most of them could walk back home in an hour if they were allowed to. and they're not allowed to. They're kept in Gaza, as I said, in a kind of permanent jail that they can't get out of. So it's the worst situation in the world.
Okay, all right. I'm going to take some phone calls. We've got some phone calls here to get to. The number is 210-614-8980. Alexander has called in. Alexander, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Alexander.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Oh, fantastic. Hi, I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and I'm a Jewish American, born in the United States. I've never been to Israel. And whenever I make comments that are in any way viewed as anti-Israeli by the Jewish community that I am a part of in San Antonio, it's as if I'm immediately ostracized. You can't have any kind of opposing view. Like, I was commenting with friends on Facebook on a post one of my Jewish friends had made that was extremely pro-Israel, essentially saying all the Palestinians should die. And I just said, you know, from a PR standpoint, Israelis have had 3 civilian casualties. The Palestinians have had close to 1,500 civilian casualties. It's a numbers thing. And as soon as you say anything like that, they're like, oh, you're anti-Israel.
Okay, Alexander.
It's anti-killing of civilians.
Okay, I appreciate your call, and thanks for calling in. So, Juan Cole, you know something about being on the end of people calling you anti-Israel.
Well, I just want to thank Alex for his call and his comment. You know, in Yiddish, there's a word mensch, which means a real human being, somebody you would admire. So Alex is a mensch, and I just want to give that shout-out. Yeah, you know, the nationalism, it's not just Jewish nationalism, which is Zionism, but nationalism in general doesn't like dissent. Remember when the Dixie Chicks got in all that trouble for being ashamed of George W. Bush's policies in Iraq? When people get all nationalistic, they get head up, and then they don't like to hear they don't like to see their parade rained on. And it's something I think as human beings we all have to fight that kind of nationalism, because it's what produced the 2 world wars. And you know, when you ask, you know, is what's going on in the Middle East going on because they're Middle Easters? No, it's mainly because of forms of nationalism. So nationalism is intolerant often as a form of culture. And I think real human beings, people who care about other human beings and have humane values, have to stand up for it, and there is a cost. There is always a cost if you dissent. And there was a cost, you know, for those white South Africans who opposed apartheid, but they won over the long run. And the American Jewish community is a group of wonderful, humane people who've made a tremendous impact on civil liberties improving in the United States. And they have often a kind of blindness to what's actually going on with this apartheid situation in the Mideast. But that blindness can't last forever. And I think especially the younger generation is beginning to understand that these policies need to be challenged.
Okay, back to the phone lines. Lauren has called in. Lauren, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
I just find the speaker's statement so one-sided, when historically the Israeli government has offered land for peace, and Hamas, the Palestinians, and the other Middle Eastern countries supporting the Palestinians have not participated in those agreements or accepted those agreements. So how can I understand that there is a humanitarian issue and it is a tragedy that the civilians are getting killed or injured, but it's their own government, their faith government, Hamas, that is putting all of this in their homes and in their schools. So how can you entirely blame the Israeli government when they really take steps to try to preserve civilian life?
Lauren, thanks for your call. Appreciate those points. Professor Juan Cole, want to respond?
Well, I think it's good to have Lauren's voice in the conversation. And obviously, there are many points of view on these things. My own point of view is very different. I probably also know a different set of facts, which is that the Israelis promised the Palestinians a state, and they promised to withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza, and instead they put several hundred thousand settlers into the West Bank, and Prime Minister Netanyahu boasted about destroying the Oslo peace process. in the late 1990s, and so I don't think it's true that the Palestinians are unwilling to make peace. I think the Israeli colonization project on the West Bank is what's made it impossible to have peace. I don't think Hamas would amount to much if the peace process had been allowed to succeed. So I think that's on Israel. They're the ones, and they also ruined John Kerry's attempt to get a peace agreement. It was the Israelis who spiked it. So the other thing to say is that there is no evidence for Hamas using human shields. The people on the ground, the journalists who see these shells and rockets coming into schools and hospitals and so forth, don't see Hamas fighters in them. Israel doesn't get off the hook in international law by saying this. That is to say, if you're after a criminal and he's hiding out in a mall in Texas, and you go in with artillery and fighter jets and you bomb the bejesus out of that mall and kill everybody in it to get at that one criminal, then that's a war crime. It's a crime against humanity. You're not allowed to do that. You have to wait till you can corner the guy in some other way. You have to send in a SWAT team. The Israelis are doing the equivalent of destroying the mall to get at the guy. And then they're saying, well, the guy, you know, it's his fault. He shouldn't have been in that mall. He's using human shields. Well, you know, if you went to the International Criminal Court in The Hague with that argument, you'd be laughed out of the court.
Back to the phone lines. Jerry has called in. Hey, Jerry, you're on the air.
Professor, to perform a thought experiment, I'd like him to use his knowledge of what he knows about Hamas and the Hamas Charter and what he believes are his attitudes about Israel and the Israelis. And I'd like him to perform the following experiment. Allow Hamas to have its way and do its will in Palestine, or versus letting the Israelis have their way and do their will in Israel and Palestine. And what does he come up with when he does that thought experiment?
Okay, Jerry, thanks for that idea. And Professor Cole.
Well, we historians like concrete facts on the ground. The fact is that Israel has made truces with Hamas, which Hamas has observed in the long term. So the argument that you can never deal with them is not true. And the fact is that we've had Israeli rule over Palestinians now since 1967, and the results are not pretty. There's 10% of the children in Gaza are stunted. There's malnutrition. There's unemployment. There's all kinds of curbing of personal freedoms. There's a pass system and a checkpoint system. There's an apartheid where Palestinians can't be on certain roads. There are settlements they can't live in. Let me turn it around to the speaker and say, just imagine that you were a Palestinian and you were living that life. What would you do about it? Would that be acceptable to you? I don't know of any American who would being treated the way the Palestinians are.
Now, Israel has a right to defend itself, correct?
It doesn't have an absolute right to defend itself. As I said, it may defend itself within the framework of international law. So it has the self-defense has to be proportionate. An Israeli gets killed, you can go in after the guys who did it. You can't go in and kill 1,000 people in response, especially with 80% of them are not involved.
And so this human shield, you dispute the fact that Hamas is storing weapons at schools and hospitals?
Yes. I dispute it. There have been a couple of instances where weapons have been found at abandoned schools. There's no evidence of Hamas storing weapons in institutions like hospitals and schools that are actively being used. It's just propaganda. It's a propaganda talking point. You know, the Gaza Strip's not big enough to swing a cat in. It's one of the most densely populated areas in the world. So if you've got Hamas fighters in Gaza, they're in amongst people. It would be impossible not to be. So saying that they're using human shields, it's just war propaganda.
Okay. Professor Juan Cole, author of The New Arabs, also the author of Engaging the Muslim World. Thank you for joining us. And this is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.